I mean, some of the scenes you will witness may appear to border on fantasy.
I can game it in a big way.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Bless you.
But
I mean,
tonight
we care, and it shows.
The law.
Of course.
You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Welcome to another edition of Media Monarchy, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com, and the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.net. It's November 9th, 2007, and it's big episode 49 of Media Monarchy. Tons of news to go over this week. Pipe bombs and nuke plants and Condoleezza Rice and AIPAC. California bioterror, martial law in Pakistan, cannon fodder, DNA, the Ron Paul money bomb, William Rodriguez in Portland, Chicago police tasering 82-year-old women. We've got curveball and phony intelligence, the loonies, future combat systems and DARPA, global warming, the 9/11 debate on the Tom Hartman show, and an apocalyptic scenario for Israel. It's episode 49 of Media Monarchy, November 9th, 2007, MediaMonarchy.com.
Push his brain, he's got a pain, he's gone insane. A bit of cranium and Zania to Kramer when he celebrate uranium with Cheney hunting oil and Iranian. Spinning on Iraqis when he scrammed with depleted uranium. Bush is working for the devil like he's Damien. Framing an economy that crashed like a Roswell alien. They mainly try to blame it on Osama. Go believe him if you want a better yet. You can bottle with Madonna with a martial law coming. You are gone with a FEMA camp. Hold you with an open-ended sentence like a comma. I'm spitting on the nasty knowledge. Bashing noggin, so-called flavor like Baskin. Robin, see the country got a massive problem when it's common to stand there cheering every fascist bombing. I smoke till I'm dumb as Sean Hannity. My parents couldn't handle me. I stare into humanity's calamity. Apparently, your kids has got insanity. I'm Michael Corleone, Bush strangled like Frank Pantangeli. I'm never hiding Ross, shouting off. Diamond Ross, rhyming soft, devils follow me. I always fight them off. Minds in a prison for the lies of living. Lie what we listen, cause they hide what we listen. Get high off the ism, better rise from my vision. Voice shivers, truth over your identity. Die for my mission. Ride when I'm spitting, cause I ride off the rhythm. If you looking for the light, then I shine through the prism. In a holographic universal rhyme, and I'm giving worship with truth warrior. I die for my mission. So once again, America's engaged in a war. For the oil, Bush's father had been aiming to score. See, he conquered Baghdad, cause his dad was mad that he couldn't steal money the Iraqis had. Now they got the country turning it over to corporations, taking the majority of wealth in the nation. Dick Cheney, the CEO of Halliburton, now they working $5 billion. A coincidence, the towers working money for the few and a murder for the many. They kill you for a dollar, but they murder you for pennies. Polluting the whole world, they robbing it blind. Now they got Bush elected as their partner in crime. The democracy is dying when the people are blind to the ways of the world, focused on the passing of time. We need to snap out of it, our time is limited. One drop of a nuclear bomb could finish it. So I'ma give it to you real slow. Here's the lowdown, rich on the world proper when they going low down. People in the third world, all of which they own now. Moving on to the next country like a hoedown. Minds in a prison for the lies of living. Lie what we listen, cause they hide what we listen. Get high off the ism, better rise from my vision. Voice give us truth, only if I die for my mission. Ride when I'm spitting, cause I ride off the rhythm. If you looking for the light, then I shine through the prism. In a holographic universal rhyme that I'm giving. Voice give us truth, only if I die for my mission. All the drinking and the cane gave me family feuds. I fight a hand in the incomes, world managing cool. If they put a man on the moon, your parents assume the human beings murder since the animals ruled. I'm stepping back and examine the zoo. I see them locked in the cage like gorillas with the bars we can't view. They blame it on the terrorists. Apparently some anarchists went and blew at McDonald's in the situation of terrorists. Rulers at the time of the pyramids who rise in the chariot. Now they want us to rise in hysteria. Used to be an ignorant soul. I saw the light man, natives and the white man. Cheney's fourth priceless. Rumsfeld dumbbells, children getting splattered with gun shells. Illuminati ritual with blood smells. Shivers never see me at the VMAs. Corporate executives scared chicken on my 12 strand of DNA. Structure but lust, receiving them dope hustler. See me fighting demons like he got in Ghostbusters. Better man fight the devil's plan. Bush stomping in your city like steak puffs, marshmallow man. Mind's in a prison for the lies of his living. Lie what we listen, if they high what we listen. Yet they high over the ism, better rise from my vision. Boy, shit is true for me, if I die for my mission. I vibe when I'm spitting cause I ride off the rhythm. If you looking for the light, then I shine through the prism. In a holographic universal rhyme that I'm giving. Boy, shit is true for me, if I die for my mission.
All right. That was Roy Shivers with Bush's Brain. He's also known as Daniel Abramson behind FalseFlagNews.com. And my name's James, and I'm behind MediaMonarchy.com. It's episode 49, November 9th, 2007. Coming to you live right now on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com. Live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. And you can also hear the show thanks to the fine folks at the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.net, Monday nights at 5 Eastern Time. And you can hit me up on MySpace and Yahoo with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And the podcasts are available almost anytime thanks to radioforall.net. So it's been a big week. It's been a big week for 9/11 visibility. We had William Rodriguez in town. We had the debate on the Tom Hartman show on Air America, originating out of Portland, yesterday on his show with Kevin Ryan and Michael Shermer. Tons of stuff to go over today, but let's hit what's on the top of the page right now on MediaMonarchy.com, coming from the AFP, the agency French press. Apocalyptic scenario if Egypt and Saudi Arabia go nuclear. That, according to Avigdor Lieberman. So, Dateline Jerusalem, Egyptian and Saudi nuclear ambitions on top of Iran's atomic drive will lead to an apocalyptic scenario, a senior Israeli cabinet minister said in comments published on Friday. Quote, if Egypt and Saudi Arabia begin nuclear programs, this can bring an apocalyptic scenario upon us, said Strategic Affairs Minister Avigdor Lieberman to the Jerusalem Post, and I got the link for you there to the original article on jpost.com. Their intentions should be taken seriously, and the declarations being made now are to prepare the world for when they decide to actually do it, said the minister, responsible for coordinating Israeli efforts against a nuclear Iran. On October 29th, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak announced a program to build several nuclear power stations, the country having abandoned an atomic energy program in 86 after the Chernobyl disaster. Jordan, one of only two Arab countries with Egypt to have signed peace deals with Israel, as well as Algeria, Libya, Yemen, and all six pro-Western Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, have also announced peaceful nuclear ambitions. Lieberman, who heads the ultra-nationalist Yisrael Beitenu party, also told the Jerusalem Post that Pakistan could pose a major threat to Israel. If the Taliban or Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden get control of Pakistan, they will have nuclear weapons for terror use, and they don't hide their opinions about Israel. Lieberman also joined the chorus of Israeli criticism against the head of UN nuclear watchdog, Mohammed El-Baradei, over comments from the Egyptian that Iran's nuclear activities pose no immediate danger. He's part of the problem, not part of the solution, said Lieberman, who's also deputy prime minister. Now, Israel, which belongs to the UN nuclear watchdog but is not a signatory to its key non-proliferation treaty, is widely considered to have the Middle East's sole, if undeclared, nuclear arsenal. And, of course, it has been declared by Olmert, and we played that clip on the show. It considers Iran its chief enemy after repeated statements by President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad that the Jewish state should be wiped off the map. And again, we've gone over that wiped off the map hoax. And it's a bad translation, even according to, I believe, The Guardian. Lieberman is known for extreme nationalist views. He advocates a land swap in which Israel would annex its largest Jewish settlements built on occupied Palestinian land and transfer Israeli territory with a large Arab population to a future Palestinian state. Yeah, probably somewhere in the middle of the Gulf Ocean. He also once sparked outrage by advocating the execution of Arab-Israeli MPs who had dealings with Palestinian Islamist movement Hamas, which Israel considers a terrorist organization, but which controls the Gaza Strip. Now, I got this story from Mike Rivero at whatreallyhappened.com, and he has his own little addendum to add to this. Memo to Strategic Affairs Minister Lieberman. Saudi Arabia and Egypt have seen very clearly, what happens to countries in the region which do not have a nuclear deterrent. Iraq never had WMDs. You knew it, the U.S. knew it, and the world knew it. Yet Iraq was attacked and occupied on the pack of lies that it did. The leaders of these two countries don't want that to happen to them, and really, who can blame them? And by the way, Minister Lieberman, the world knows that Israel has nukes. Your conviction of Mordecai Vanunu for having committed the crime of telling the world the truth has confirmed it. So before screaming about Egypt and Saudi Arabia, why doesn't Israel come to the negotiating table honestly and become a participant in the IAEA? Why don't they? So moving on and jumping around, maybe jumping around a little bit on this episode 49 of Media Monarchy. There was a debate yesterday on the Tom Hartman Show on Air America, played locally here on KPOJ 620, I think, something like that. I listened to it live because I wasn't sure when I would get a recording of it, and of course, it's excruciating to listen to corporate radio and their massive 10-minute commercial blocks that are hard to get through. But the story's posted up, 9/11 debate on the Tom Hartman Show, coming from 911blogger.com. There's a few different audio links. You can just stream the show, or you can download the MP3, and they're pretty much commercial-free. So we're going to listen to just a little bit of the debate on the Tom Hartman Show that featured Michael Shermer of Skeptic Magazine, skeptic.com, and he also had Kevin Ryan from Journal of 911studies.com. Kevin Ryan used to work for Underwriters Laboratory, who certified the steel in the World Trade Center that said that it could withstand temperatures far above what it withstood on 9/11. The interesting thing is, I think the person who comes out of this debate looking the best is actually Tom Hartman himself, showing himself, as usual, to be a really astute, intelligent guy. I really like him. I'm glad he took over for old schmucko Stuart Smalley, whatever his name is. So yeah, we're going to listen to just a little bit of this, and we'll comment on it afterwards.
Well, welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, second hour of our program. What actually happened on 9/11? And why is this an enduring mystery, I guess, shall we say? And I just, first of all, I want to establish where I stand on this, and secondly, the ground rules of this thing. Lamar Waldron and I spent 17 years researching who killed Jack Kennedy. The killing of Kennedy, which happened in 63 when I was 12 years old, was the defining event for my generation. Jack, Robert, Martin Luther King, I mean, there's conspiracy theories around all of them. And Lamar and I spent 17 years, well over $100,000, maybe as much as twice that in dollars, investigating this thing, suing the federal government, filing FOIA filings, getting thousands of documents declassified. We ended up writing an 840-page book with over 2,400 footnotes, which was made into a made-for-TV, a one-hour special by NBC, which shows about every month on the Discovery Channel. And the book is called Ultimate Sacrifice, about the Kennedy assassination. And I can tell you, having shown up many, many years, every year down in Dallas is the, quote, conspiracy nut convention. And I mean, that's what the outsiders call it, the JFK Researchers Convention, and where people share notes and try and figure out what's going on. And Lamar and I think we actually figured it out. But I can tell you, it took 17 years, and it took a hell of a lot of work. And I'm very skeptical of anybody who says, I know absolutely what went on, or I know absolutely what didn't go on. So my position is very agnostic on this. I think it's going to take, you know, I mean, here we are with the JFK assassination 40 years later. I think it's going to, 44 years later. I think it's going to take a long time to figure out. That said, I think that a good, healthy discussion, a good, healthy debate, and raising the questions and for that matter, raising the answers to the questions, is a reasonable and healthy thing. Michael Shermer is with us. He's the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, the executive director of the Skeptics Society, their website, skeptic.com. Michael, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Sorry.
And Kevin Ryan is with us. He's the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, the former site manager for Underwriter Laboratories in South Bend, and the website journalof911studies.com. Kevin Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both with us. Michael is taking the position. I'm not even going to try and characterize you guys' position. My goal here, my job here, is to moderate. The one thing I'm going to ask is that each of you keep your questions or answers relatively short, and that nobody try to filibuster the other. It's just, you know, and if it happens, I'll just jump in. So let's start first of all with you, Kevin. You're taking opening statement.
Oh, okay. Well, really what it looks like we have here, we have a couple of hypotheses, and it's different than JFK because it's not really a question of a conspiracy theory or not. That term actually is wrong for several reasons here, because unless you believe that the crimes of 9/11 were committed by one person acting alone, you believe in a conspiracy theory. Actually, you don't believe in a theory at all. You believe in some sort of hypothesis, because the two major hypotheses are both not well accepted. The official hypothesis is that Al-Qaeda, with no help from any government agency, committed these irrational acts of violence, and we're not really sure why. It requires extreme negligence on the part of numerous government agencies, and multiple false stories have been told. And in the end, it just gives us a reason to invade these strategically important lands. And on the other hand, we've got this alternative hypothesis that suggests that government agencies were involved and either let it happen or made it happen. And in other words, the crimes of 9/11 were committed by those with the means to accomplish them and those who benefit from the war on terror. So along with that is, if you believe in, if you lean toward the alternative hypothesis, you also believe there's very likely been an intentional cover-up, which can be seen as a greater crime.
So that's just a couple minutes of the Kevin Ryan, Michael Shermer debate on the Tom Hartman Show yesterday, November 8th. And so there's not, I didn't play enough actually to comment a whole lot on. But it's funny because as Kevin Ryan goes into it, basically just breaking down the paradigm, Shermer has to backpedal and go, oh, well, this isn't really where I thought we were going. Basically saying he wanted to focus, as they always do, on the vagaries of the Pentagon hit and all these sorts of things that we're not going to figure out. But when you talk about, again, the drills, all the drills going on, when you talk about the guys training at U.S. air bases, Able Danger, they had been identified, they were stopped. They were stopped by good agents and were told, no, they're part of an operation, let them go. Look it up, Able Danger, and Kurt Weldon, Anthony Schaefer, and all that. Norman Mineta's testimony about the page coming in telling Cheney, sir, the plane's 30 miles out, 20 miles out, 10 miles out. Did the order still stand? Of course the order still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? And so there was also a little caller segment where a lot of good calls come in, a couple crappy ones, but even We Are Change LA, the guys who crashed the Bill Maher show, call in and bring up good points. Like good 9/11 activists, they get on, bust out the website, the facts, get in, get out, done. So definitely go pull those down and listen to them. They're commercial free. They're highly informative. And there you go. So let's jump on to something even more controversial that I posted up this morning. Coming from newsbusters.org, which I don't usually go to that site. They're generally neocon dummies. They're exposing the great liberal media. However, this one's documented. Weather Channel founder says that global warming is the greatest scam in history. If the founder of the Weather Channel spoke out strongly against the man-made global warming myth, might media members notice? We're going to find out the answer to that question for John Coleman, who's a meteorologist, founded the Weather Channel. I've got the link to his little wiki bio, but he wrote an article, and it's published at Ice Cap, and we'll see if it garners some attention from the press, assuming journalism hasn't been completely replaced by propagandist activism. So, reading from John Coleman's article on Ice Cap, quote, "It is the greatest scam in history. I'm amazed, appalled, and highly offended by it. Global warming, it's a scam. Some dastardly scientists with environmental and political motives manipulated long-term scientific data to create an illusion of rapid global warming. Other scientists of the same environmental wacko type jumped into the circle to support and broaden the research to further enhance the totally slanted, bogus global warming claims. Their friends in government steered huge research grants their way to keep the movement going, and soon they claimed to be a consensus. Environmental extremists, notable politicians among them, then teamed up with the movie, media, and other liberal environmentalist journalists to create this wild scientific scenario of the civilization threatening environmental consequences from global warming unless we adhere to their radical agenda. Now their ridiculous, manipulated science has been accepted as fact and become a cornerstone issue for CNN, CBS, NBC, the Democratic Political Party, the governor of California, school teachers, and in many cases, well-informed but very gullible environmental conscientious citizens. Only one reporter at ABC has been allowed to counter the global warming frenzy with one 15-minute documentary segment. I've read dozens of scientific papers, I've talked with numerous scientists, I've studied, I've talked about it, I know I'm correct, there's no runaway climate change. The impact of humans on climate is not catastrophic, our planet is not in peril. I'm incensed by the incredible media glamour, the politically correct silliness, and rude dismissal of counter-arguments by the high priests of global warming. In time, a decade or two, the outrageous scam will be obvious." So that is John Coleman, meteorologist, and the founder of the Weather Channel, with his article, Global Warming is the Greatest Scam in History, published at icecap.us. And that full article is linked up. I have it here in front of me, but we just read the pertinent parts. John Coleman's bio, again, the wiki bio for what that's worth, American meteorologist and founder of the Weather Channel, started his career at WCIA in Champaign, Illinois, doing weekend weather and a local show called At the Hop. He later became the weather anchor for WCIA's sister station, WMBD, in Peoria, Illinois, and later weather anchor for WMAQ and WLS, and weatherman in New York, and on Good Morning America for 7 years. During his time at Chicago's WLS, Coleman was one of Chicago's most popular meteorologists, famous for his amusing and irreverent style. He popularized the word thorms and thours to represent thunderstorms and thundershowers. After founding and leaving the Weather Channel, Coleman became weather anchor at independent television station KUSI in San Diego as his retirement job. Coleman believes that global warming, quote, is a non-event, a manufactured crisis, and a total scam, end quote. And that's all that's up there on his little wiki bio. So one more related article that's linked up from our own Oregonian, written by Dylan Rivera, Dateline Chicago. But it's about Portland. In a bold move to curb the growth of greenhouse gas emissions from the Portland area, city officials plan to charge builders hundreds of thousands for each new home that is not extremely energy efficient. And it would require, as part of every existing home sale, that an energy efficiency report be done by home inspectors. And who would those inspectors be? Believed to be the first of its kind in the nation, the carbon fee, that's a carbon tax, an inspection requirement would levy taxes upon builders who merely comply with the energy efficiency requirements of the Oregon Building Code, already one of the most stringent in the nation. It would then pay cash rewards to developers who make buildings that save at least 45% more energy than the code requires. The plan will go before Portland residents in hearings in January. With passage, the carbon tax would be in place by 2010. Builders in Portland on Wednesday were already pushing back. And that article goes on. But like I've told you before, you should Google carbon tax, because that's the agenda coming forward. And it basically has to do with calling carbon dioxide, one of the main building blocks of life on our planet, a harmful gas. I thought it was kind of in that exchange with oxygen and plants and animals and humans, and that we kind of needed it. When you also look at other planets in our solar systems and some of their ice caps and features melting and shifting and moving, Are we doing that? I don't think so. It's the sun. I think it's probably got to be the sun. And humans haven't been keeping records quite well enough for the tens of dozens of millions of years that we've been floating around in this galaxy. So how the fuck do we know what the sun's going to do and what it has done and what it's going to do again, or whether or not it's just heating up before it pops? Meanwhile, there's real environmental hazards. GMO food and spider goats and all that. So we need to look more into it, I think. I'm just throwing the info out there. I haven't quite figured it all out myself. I kind of see it as the next wave of fear and control that they're going to put over us. It's like, are you getting tired and a little disbelieving of the terrorism scare? Well, we've got your next scare ready to go. And so that kind of seems like the difference of the phony choice that we have sometimes of which kind of globalist New World Order do you want. Do you want the phony, happy, friendly, environmental socialism? Or do you want the Orwellian boot on the face forever? Take your pick. Which I guess... don't really want the boot in the face, so we'll see. So let's move on, like my name was .org, to the register.co.uk, and we got a couple of future combat systems, robotic army, virtual satellite, DARPA, crazy shit to go over. So yeah, first from the Register. Pentagon says, not in so many words, but that our new robot army will be controlled by malware. This is written by Lewis Page, posted up Tuesday, the 6th of November. A U.S. Defense Department advisory board has warned of the danger that American war robots, scheduled for delivery within a decade, might be riddled with malicious code. The kill machines will use software largely written overseas, and it is feared that sinister forces might meddle with its production, thus gaining control of the future mechanoid military. The most eye-catching of the equipment mentioned is the lineup of the U.S. Army's Future Combat Systems, FCS, program. And there's the link right to the Army's Future Combat Systems webpage. FCS was originally supposed to include a wide range of deadly unmanned systems, including a small, possibly rocket-firing, flying Dalek, a heavily armed autonomous helicopter gunship, and a robot tank packing guided missiles and cannons. There would also be intelligent sensor minefields, droid mule transport systems, and loads of other stuff, and all of it's supposed to be linked together by a data network. And so there's a nice graph that you can link to on there that shows how the future combat system scenario would be basically a bunch of robots and soldiers and robot soldiers all linked together by central mainframes and satellites. Some of this has been scratched from the plans of late to save money. Fans of Keith Laumer's Bolo novels will be sorry to hear that the robotanks have gone, but Future Combat Systems remains a big deal, and parts of it are meant to arrive within a few years. On the network, the strong become stronger, runs the U.S. Army slogan. That's the Future Combat System slogan. But now the U.S. Defense Science Board, in a report being analyzed by the military press, and that link is there for you, have started to worry about that network. The System of Systems Common Operating Environment, SOSCO, and the Integrated Computer System Operating System rely predominantly on commercial off-the-shelf and open-source software, say the government advisors. So some of it's almost 99%, some of it's 80%. But apparently the FCS program office has admitted there's a low to moderate risk that malicious code could be inserted and exploited. It seems there's also an irresistible tendency to replace relatively secure special-purpose communications with general-purpose internet protocol. If that doesn't boil down to a teenager with a laptop seizing control of robot helicopter gunships, we don't know what does. We'll say that again. Robot gunship army menace to society. And it tells you to run, but it won't be any use, but you should run anyway. The soldiery have come up with some cunning plans to deal with this problem, including that of using military, or rather undercover, software buyers so that the vendors wouldn't know they were selling to the military. There's also a suggestion that the profit motive will assure a clean code in shrink-wrapped consumer software. The Science Board guys said they were skeptical of these thoughts and concluded that malicious code is a key concern of the FCS program. And you can read the full report in all its hefty PDF glory at a link provided. Still, some things might be okay. Apparently, the incredibly expensive new F-22 Raptor stealth superjet is pretty secure. So the Raptor finally has clear and well-defined purpose, saving the taxpayers from the hacker robot army. So that's the first one. And then in a related note, we're going to jump to the Danger Room blog on Wired. Army's robotic armed combat vehicle rolls out. We now know that there are robotic cars smart enough to drive themselves around a city. The next step, give those vehicles automatic weapons, of course. Enter the Black Knight. K-N-I-G-H-T, a very early prototype of an unmanned combat vehicle developed by arms maker BAE Systems out of Britain for the U.S. Army. From the outside, the Knight doesn't look all that different from the armored vehicles used by the American military in combat zones around the world, but soldiers can also get out of the 9.5-ton Knight and control the vehicle from afar, including a custom one-off 30mm gun and coaxial machine gun. Or the troops can just chill out and let the thing drive itself. The Knight uses advanced robotic technology for autonomous mobility, according to BAE. This capability allows the Black Knight to plan routes, maneuver on the planned route, and avoid obstacles, all without operator intervention. Jumping to the end, last month, a set of South African remotely operated 35mm guns spun out of control and killed 9 soldiers. The Black Knight basically operates under the same principles, taking that South African weapon and making it mobile and radio-operated. What could possibly go wrong? And I'm sure we'll see. Jumping now to thought-criminal.org, virtual satellites are being predicted by DARPA, which of course they would know. Dateline Anaheim, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, is predicting that in the future, virtual satellites circling the globe will peer down on enemy forces. And you and I. Instead of one expensive 10,000-pound spacecraft, the spy camera will float alone, unattached to other components. The onboard processor and communications node, for example, will orbit nearby, and the 3 building blocks in the system will be linked wirelessly. The System F6 program, future fast, flexible, fraction-free flying spacecraft united by information exchange, that's the F-6, would allow the Air Force or the National Reconnaissance Office to easily swap out outdated or broken components. Flexibility in the technology that enables it is the cornerstone of DARPA's vision of a new space architecture. Owen Brown, a program manager in the agency's virtual space office, said at the DARPA Tech Conference 2007, and I got a link for that. Founded 50 years ago in response to the Soviet Union's launch of Sputnik, DARPA was a key player in creating today's U.S. military space architecture. Now the agency wants to tear that structure down and create new paradigms for space-based systems. The key word project managers stressed is flexibility. Today's giant military spacecraft take anywhere from 5 to 10 years to complete the development cycle. As they're being built, technology advances, making some of their components outdated as soon as they reach orbit. To prevent catastrophic failure in orbit, redundancy must be built in, which adds weight, cost, and space to the system. These so-called monolithic spacecraft are vulnerable to launch failures, software engineering bugs, or component malfunction that could set the program back by billions of dollars and years of development. And that goes on and on, and there's lots of links and lots of illustrations for you to check out. A link up to the DARPA big PDF, and it's their big think tank white paper about the Black Knight, and about the satellites, and about F-6, and all that good stuff. And it's too long. I shouldn't have included it. I've got to scroll all through it in their glossary of terms and uncertainty and redundancy. I do link up to the DARPA entry on sourcewatch.org, which fortunately they add a trackback link. And so I've been trying to phase out linking to Wikipedia all the time, so I'm trying to go to SourceWatch whenever I can. And with the automatic trackback, I noticed MediaMonarchy.com gets lots of extra hits. So I'm going to keep doing that. So coming from SourceWatch.org, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency is the central R&D organization for the DoD. It manages and directs selected basic and applied research and development projects for DoD and pursues research and technology where risk and payoff are both very high and where success may provide dramatic advances for traditional military roles and missions. So that's kind of a scant entry from SourceWatch, but we also have their entry for the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office. They, quote, designs, builds, and operates the nation's reconnaissance satellites. NRO products, provided to an expanding list of customers like the CIA and the DoD, can warn of potential trouble spots around the world, help plan military operations, and monitor the environment. The global information grid, if you will. As part of the 14-member intelligence community, the NRO plays a primary role in achieving information superiority for the U.S. government and armed forces. A DoD agency, the NRO is staffed by DoD and CIA personnel. It's funded through the National Reconnaissance Program, part of the National Foreign Intelligence Program, and the organization was declassified in September 92, followed by the location of its headquarters in Spooktown, Chantilly, Virginia, in 1994. Now, tying all this up with the future combat systems, coming from the Sydney Morning Herald, SMH.com, arms makers are the only ones winning the war on terror. Arms manufacturers are making record profits from the war on terrorism and unprecedented spending on weapons programs. The massive earnings have drawn condemnation from Australian defense experts who say expensive weapons such as jet fighters, warships, and satellites are not the way to combat terrorism. The world's biggest arms maker, Lockheed Martin, in the U.S., maker of fighter jets including the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which Australia is buying, announced last week it had increased third-quarter profits by 22%, up to $11 billion U.S. Northrop Grumman, maker of aircraft carriers, submarines, and bombers, increased profits 62%, up to $489 million U.S. At General Dynamics, maker of the Abrams tank, which Australia has just bought, profits climbed 24% to $544 million U.S. Britain's BAE said its profits were up 27% to $1.23 billion U.S. In Australia, profits for the government-owned naval ship and submarine builder ASC rose 60% last year to $30 million, and the company was set up to build the Collins-class submarines and is involved in the $8 billion air warfare destroyer project. Now, Hugh White, professor of strategic studies at the Australian National University, and I have the quote to his, or rather the link to his bio page at the university, said the big-ticket weapons were designed to contain China, not combat terrorism. They don't admit to it. They sell it to the people as a response to terrorism, but that's not what they're doing, Professor White said. He also said Australia's multi-billion dollar defense purchases, such as the Abrams tanks, warships, and Globemaster transport planes, would be part of any U.S. military operation in the Middle East or against China. Professor Kevin Clements, director of the Australian Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Queensland, said the war on terrorism was a front to keep up arms spending, to maintain the U.S.'s ability to fight wars on three fronts, Asia, the Middle East, and Europe. So there you go. That's the Sydney Morning Herald laying it out quite plainly. Jumping to the Canadian press, and this is just a follow-up on something we hit a couple weeks ago, but still, the loonie, the Canadian dollar, is now past $1.10 in the U.S. How high will the loonie go, asks Nina Chowdhury of the Canadian Press, Dateline Toronto. The Canadian dollar's meteoric rise accelerated this last week, rising 2 cents in less than 24 hours. The loonie broke through the U.S. $1.10 barrier in overseas trading last Wednesday, initially hitting the $1.10.02 cents U.S. mark. It dropped back down to 109.6 before taking off again and landing well above 1.10. Analysts say it doesn't appear that the loonie will be returning to Earth anytime soon. And that goes on to basically get into Canadian economic news. But what we know is that gold is skyrocketing, the dollar is dying, the loonie is skyrocketing, the euro is skyrocketing, people are breaking into a run to get out of the dollar. Top models are being asked to be paid in anything but the U.S. dollar. Bernanke said the economy is going to slow down, and of course it did after he said it. And that was just yesterday. So the economy's looking rough. And I only have a couple nickels to rub together, but I'm about ready to turn it into gold and keep it under my mattress. Shifting gears, however, let's jump to, I think this is originally where it was published, HuffingtonPost.com. The writer is Jim Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S. And this is big. A war pitched with a curveball. And curveball was the name. Curveball was the name of one of our great intelligence providers leading us into war with Iraq. I'll give you a little bit right here. Jim Wallace writing. Watch the 60 Minutes from Sunday night or read the story. It revealed the results of a 2-year investigation into the source of the key piece of information which was used by the Bush administration as proof that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. This was the information that Colin Powell used in his now famous February 5th, 2003 testimony at the United Nations, reporting an eyewitness account that Saddam had mobile biochemical weapons program. The source, ironically codenamed Curveball, was a young Iraqi defector in Germany who claimed he was a top student employed by a so-called seed purification plant that was really a biochemical weapons facility, and that he saw trucks moving in and out to be armed with weapons of mass destruction. Problem is that he wasn't, after all, a top student, wasn't there during the time he reported, and got caught stealing once, or maybe twice, equipment from his next employer, and there turned out to be walls at the alleged entrances and exits where the trucks were supposed to be going in and out. For the first time, we know his name, Rafid Ahmed Alwan. Apparently, he lied because he wanted a green card in Germany, where he now lives. Turns out the Germans told the Americans this, and that his testimony was unconfirmed, but the CIA wanted to use it anyway. Watch the 60 Minutes interview with former senior CIA official Tyler Drumheller, who was asked whether Curveball's assertion was essential to going to war with Iraq. He replied, if they had not had Curveball, they would probably have found something else because there was great determination to do it. But the information Curveball provided was the absolutely essential case for going to war. It was crucial to CIA Director George Tenet's telling the White House that the case proving Saddam Hussein had WMDs was a, quote, slam dunk. Powell apparently believed the CIA's information, as secretaries of state normally do, when he told the world that Saddam had mobile biochemical weapons program at the same time his successor, Condoleezza Rice, was talking about mushroom clouds. And no America had interviewed Curveball, nor had they visited the plant, when Powell told the world about the Iraqi WMD program. And it turns out that inspectors went to see the alleged WMD facility just days later, saw the walls where trucks were supposed to be going in and out of, and discovered it was just a seed purification plant after all. But we never heard anything about that visit, and the war started a few weeks later, a war justified on false information.
Did Saddam Hussein have weapons of mass destruction? No, he did not. We've known that for some time now. So where did the intelligence come from that he was building up his arsenal? Fantastically, the most compelling part came from one obscure Iraqi defector who came in and out of history like a comet. His code name, ironically, was Curveball, and his information became the pillar of the case Colin Powell made to the United Nations before the war. Who is Curveball, and how did he fool the world's elite intelligence agencies? We spent 2 years, traveled to 9 countries, trying to solve the mystery. We talked to intelligence sources, to people who knew Curveball, and to people who worked with him. Curveball's real name has never been made public, nor has any video of him until now. This is Rafid Ahmed Alwan at a Baghdad wedding in 1993. 6 years before he became the key Iraqi source known as Curveball. 6 years before he helped launch the war. Former CIA senior official Tyler Drumheller was an insider and watched Kerbal emerge from nowhere.
How important was Kerbal in taking us to war in Iraq?
If they had not had Kerbal, they'd probably found something else because there was a great determination to do it. But going to war in Iraq, under the circumstances we did, Kerbal was the absolutely essential case.
How did Rafat Alwan become Kerbal? Our investigation led us to Germany, where in November 1999, Alwan arrived by car and requested asylum at this refugee center outside Nuremberg. The 32-year-old told German intelligence that he was a chemical engineer in Saddam's Iraq, that he had done so well in university, he had been made director of this site at Jurf al-Nadaf, just outside Baghdad. The Iraqis called it a seed purification plant. In reality, he said, the place was secretly making mobile biological weapons. We've diagrammed how Alwan described the complex to the Germans. He said specially equipped trucks made their way to one end of Warehouse 1, entered doors there, hooked up to hoses and pumps, and brewed biological agents. The germ trucks then exited hidden doors on the other side. Alwan's story fit what Western intelligence agencies feared. Saddam might turn to mobile weapons to evade American bombs. The Germans hit Alwan in Nuremberg, then later in the town of Erlangen. He was given a code name, Kerbal. He was interrogated once a week, sometimes twice, for a year and a half. He told the Germans he didn't want to meet with Americans. Only summaries of his debriefings were transmitted to Washington. Still, there were enough details to convince analysts at the CIA.
Kerbal was the one piece of evidence where they could say, look at this, if they have this capability, they can transport biological weapons, anthrax, all these horrible weapons, they can attack our troops with them, they can give them to terrorist groups.
One of Kerbal's reports was especially alarming, proof that the agents were lethal, something Kerbal claimed he had seen while working at Jurf al-Nadaf.
He said in 1998, working around these tanks, there was even an accident. 12 people were killed, and that got everybody's attention.
So much so that in February 2001, German and American experts met in Munich to discuss Kerbal. The Americans revealed they had located Jurf al-Nadaf on overhead imagery. We found it on Google Earth. The imagery was very close to what Kerbal had described, with one exception.
If you look at the photos, all the way back to 1998, there was a wall that was built there.
A wall.
Like a cinder block wall that nothing could go through.
The wall stood right in front of where Kerbal said the trucks went in. CIA analysts who believed in Kerbal had an explanation.
There was an idea that it could have been a fake wall.
The analysts believed Iraq had put up a fake wall to make the Americans think no trucks could pass through. The analysts also believed Kerbal because he named names. He claimed that Dr. Basil Al-Sati, a noted nuclear scientist, was a senior official in Iraq's mobile bioweapons program. British intelligence found Dr. Basil outside of Iraq and pressed him on Jurf al-Nadaf. So did we.
Rafat Alwan told German intelligence that you personally were fully involved in the project to use Jurf al-Nadaf for mobile biological weapons.
Big lie.
If something were going on there, if there were...
I would have known, definitely.
There are people in the American intelligence community
yeah.
who believe that seed purification is a cover for biological weapons production.
No. It was really seed purification.
Seed purification?
Yes.
The next day, December 21st, Tenet met with President Bush and told him, making a public case that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction was, quote, a slam dunk. Making that case would be Secretary of State Colin Powell before the United Nations. Powell sent his chief of staff, Colonel Larry Wilkerson, to the CIA to prepare the presentation. Wilkerson says Tenet and his experts brought up Iraq's mobile bioweapons program.
They presented it in a very dynamic, dramatic, we know this is accurate way.
Does it make any difference that the source on this was a first-hand witness?
Certainly did. This was a man who had actually been in the belly of the beast. He had been in the lab. He had been there when an accident occurred. He'd seen people killed. And the implication there was, strong implication, that they weren't killed because of the accident and the explosion. They were killed because they were contaminated. Yes, the source was very credible, as it was presented by the CIA.
And Powell accepted all this on blind faith?
Well, you're the Secretary of State. You're not the head of intelligence for the United States. And you depend on the director of Central Intelligence to assimilate all the intelligence community's input and give it to you.
Once the speech was ready, Wilkerson felt the section on mobile bioweapons was the crown jewel.
This was the strongest part of the Secretary's presentation.
And Secretary Powell was convinced as well.
I'm convinced he was convinced.
What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
On February 5th, 2003, Powell told the world that Saddam Hussein had mobile biological weapons. The source? Curveball.
The source was an eyewitness, an Iraqi chemical engineer who supervised one of these facilities. He actually was present during biological agent production runs. He was also at the site when an accident occurred in 1998. 12 technicians died from exposure to biological agents.
Prominently displayed were models of the mobile trucks Curveball had sketched to the Germans. The most damning evidence in the speech had come from a source no American had interviewed. Just 3 days later, UN inspectors in Iraq visited a suspected WMD location, Jerf al-Nadaf, Curveball's secret site. And what did they find there? A wall. The very wall that had appeared on the overhead imagery back in 2001. Curveball had claimed the mobile bioweapons trucks entered through doors at one end of Warehouse 1.
When the inspectors examined the facility, they found that this was an impossibility.
Jim Corcoran, whose job it was to relay intelligence to the inspectors in Iraq, learned the wall blocked any entrance to the warehouse. As for Curveball's hidden doors at the other end that would allow the trucks to exit?
Again, there was a wall there, no doors, and outside there was a stone fence that would have made it impossible for this to have occurred.
Corcoran knew Jerf al-Nadaf was of great importance, so he sent inspectors back 20 days later to take samples to see if any traces of biological agents were there.
They proved negative.
There was nothing there.
Nothing there.
But the inspectors' findings in Iraq made no impact. The war began 3 weeks later. Once the U.S. took over Iraq and started looking for WMD, Curveball's story began to unravel. His university record was located. We obtained a copy. Rafid Ahmad Alwan, a.k.a. Curveball, had claimed to the Germans he graduated at the top of his class in chemical engineering. Well, not quite.
It's 59, 50, 50, 50, 50, 67. I can see all his marks are 50-50s.
Out of 100.
Out of 100, of course.
We showed it to Dr. Basel, Alwan's former boss and a scientist himself.
Not a great student.
Never.
Not only that. It turns out Jerf al-Nadaf was a seed purification plant after all. Dr. Basel was the head of production design. Alwan worked for him as an engineer, but only while the facility was being built.
Rafid left few months after we finished Jerf al-Nadaf, which was, I would expect Rafid left sometime 1995.
He did. We've discovered Alwan then worked at the Babel Television Production Company, where he stole expensive equipment. This is a copy of an arrest warrant that was issued for him. Charges were dropped when Alwan agreed to repay Babel. After that misadventure, the man who invited Alwan to his wedding, Dr. Hilal al-Dulaimi, says Alwan's career took an even more unlikely turn.
He was working for cosmetics.
Cosmetics?
Yes. He did some homemade cosmetics.
And as for that biological accident that supposedly killed 12 people at Jerf al-Nadaf in 1998, it never happened. Rafid Alwan wasn't even in Iraq when he said it happened. He had left the country, first traveling to Jordan, then Egypt, then Libya, before making his way to Morocco. From there, Alwan's trail ran cold until he showed up in Germany and became Curveball. The case finally ended in Munich in March 2004 when the Germans allowed a CIA officer to interrogate Curveball.
And the key thing, I think, was the wall. He showed him the pictures of the wall.
To which Curveball said?
You doctored these pictures. And he said, no, we didn't. And he said, we didn't doctor.
The wall had been built in 1997. Curveball didn't know it existed because he had already left Jerf al-Nadaf.
Curveball was caught.
And Curveball said, I don't think I'm going to say anything.
The CIA finally acknowledged Curveball was a fraud. But why did Curveball do it? Former CIA insider Tyler Drumheller has an idea.
It was a guy trying to get his green card, essentially, in Germany, playing the system for what it was worth. It just shows sort of the law of unintended consequences.
Rafid Alwan got what he wanted. He's thought to be living in Germany today, most likely under a new name, after pulling off one of the deadliest con jobs of our time.
And that's the entire 60 Minutes clip about Curveball, and yet again documenting the complete lies and fraud that took us to war in Iraq. Shifting gears once again, let's jump to the New York Times. Chicago police taser 82-year-old woman. From the AP, Dateline, Chicago, and Chicago's police department is investigating an officer's use of a taser last month on an 82-year-old woman who police say was swinging a hammer when they arrived. Lillian Fletcher was rushed to the hospital after being jolted by the taser last week, but has been released, police said Tuesday. Officials within the city's Department on Aging went to her home on October 29th to make a welfare check and called police when they saw Fletcher in a window swinging a hammer, police spokeswoman Monique Bond said. Officers arrived in an attempt to subdue Fletcher. One of them used a taser. The department is trying to determine whether the officer violated department policy on the use of stun guns. Fletcher said Tuesday that officers pushed their way into her home. They shocked me, she said. Fletcher at times sounded confused during the telephone interview. Her granddaughter, Tracy Taylor, told the Chicago Sun-Times that her grandmother has schizophrenia and dementia. My grandmother's easily confused, Taylor told the newspaper, adding that the woman can be belligerent, but is about 5 feet 1 inches tall and weighs about 160. I just don't think they should be tasing 82-year-old women. That's ridiculous. Tasers use compressed nitrogen to fire two barbed darts that can penetrate clothing to deliver a 50,000-volt shock to immobilize people. Touted by law enforcement officials as less lethal than other ways of subduing combative people in high-risk situations, the weapons have come under criticism nationwide after they were blamed for several deaths. In 2005, the police superintendent at the time suspended the distribution of stun guns after the deaths of two people who had been hit by police with tasers. Today, about 150 field training officers are set to be issued new tasers, and about 200 sergeants have had the weapons for about 5 years, Monique said. The human rights group Amnesty International has voiced concerns that police departments are starting to use tasers more routinely than in cases of serious danger. Taser use by police drew national attention recently when police stunned and arrested a University of Florida student after his fervent videotaped outburst at an event with Senator John Kerry in September. In Ohio, a patrolman accused of repeatedly jolting a woman who had been arrested with a taser gun faces disciplinary hearing today. The Tribune Chronicle of Warren reported the woman had been arrested because she was acting unruly at a bar, police said, blah, blah, blah. So more tasering. It's their first choice. Don't tase me, bro. Moving to Homeland Stupidity and the Transportation Safety Administration with a couple links from marktalk.com. And this has to do with the recent revelations about faked test results. So the TSA airport security test results faked. You know, those tests of airport security, the ones where undercover agents posing as terrorists try to smuggle bombs, bomb parts, and other weapons onto aircraft. And are you aware that in the most recent tests, agents were able to walk through airport security carrying nuclear materials 75% of the time? That number becomes even more shocking when you learn that Mike Restovich, assistant administrator of TSA's Office of Security Operations, apparently sends out email warnings to screeners in advance. These warnings even include the physical description of the undercover agents and what to look for, and Mr. Magoo at the checkpoint there still couldn't Sherlock his way to figuring it out. And a couple stories to back this up, coming from the AP, Dateline Washington, the Transportation Security Administration touts its programs to ensure security by using undercover operatives to test its airport screeners. In one instance, however, the agency thwarted such a test by alerting screeners across the country that it was underway, even providing descriptions of the undercover agents. The government routinely runs covert tests at airports to ensure that security measures in place are sufficient to stop a terrorist from bringing something dangerous onto a plane. Alerting screeners when the undercover officer is coming and what the person looks like would kind of defeat the purpose. But that's exactly what happened on April 28, 2006, according to an email from a top TSA official who oversees security operations. In an email to more than a dozen recipients, including airport security staff, the TSA official warned that, quote, several airport authorities and airport police departments have recently received informal notice, end quote, of security testing being carried out by the Department of Transportation and the Federal Aviation Administration. The email from the aforementioned Mike Restovich, assistant administrator at TSA's Office of Security Operations, relayed an alert that described a couple who were testing security. The woman is white, but has an Oriental woman's picture on her ID card, it stated. They will print a boarding pass from a flight, change the date, get through security, if not noticed, and try to board a flight and place a bag in the overhead. Because the pair had altered the date on the boarding pass, the email advised alert security line vendors to be aware of subtle alterations to the date. The TSA Inspector General is investigating the incident, and the agency would not discuss details of the case because it's part of an ongoing investigation. Yeah, that's the same reason why they won't give us the Pentagon footage. TSA spokeswoman Ellen Howell said, quote, "We are confident in the overall integrity of the program. Tip-offs are not a systemic problem because we do so much testing." Lawmakers are asking for more details on the incident as well. Quote, "Any effort to undermine the integrity of covert testing of TSA screening checkpoints is unacceptable," Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, wrote in a letter Thursday to the TSA. And Thompson, and we've mentioned him several times, chairs the House Homeland Security Committee. Shifting gears one more time, let's jump to rawstory.com, and this one's all about spying. AT&T whistleblower says, "I was forced to connect the Big Brother machine." And we've hit this before, and we even played some of the Frontline episode about home rooms in AT&T with splitter cables that lets the NSA siphon a copy of every bit of web traffic. So here we have a whistleblower named Mark Klein basically saying that the NSA monitors all web traffic. A former technician at AT&T who alleges that the telecom forwards virtually all of its internet traffic into a, quote, secret room to facilitate government spying, says the whole operation reminds him of something out of Orwell's 1984.
In room 226 of the Dirksen building in Washington tomorrow, the Senate Judiciary Committee will consider whether to protect some of America's most powerful corporate executives from the legal consequences of having spied on the rest of us in this country. And on our third story tonight, an AT&T whistleblower today told members of Congress much more than that is at stake with the secret crimes that took place at room 641A of AT&T's Folsom Street facility in San Francisco and potentially at others across the country. Specifically, retired 22-year AT&T technician Mark Klein says that despite Mr. Bush's claims, the U.S. government used AT&T's cooperation to spy not only on overseas communications, but to vacuum up virtually all of America's use of the internet for years. Email, Googling, web surfing, you name it. Thanks to AT&T's secure rooms like 641A in San Francisco, Cisco, accessible only to those cleared by the NSA. Klein obtaining AT&T schematics showing how the company used splitters to send secure room 641A a duplicate of every fiber optic signal routed through its facilities and involved not just AT&T customers, but virtually every internet and telecommunications company and virtually all email and web traffic in the country, without a warrant, without any mechanism for separating domestic from overseas, without separating suspect from citizen. We welcome now former AT&T technician Mark Klein, whose documentation and claims are now part of a class action lawsuit against AT&T, one of 38 telecom spy lawsuits AT&T so far declining to comment on the specifics of these allegations. Mr. Klein, great thanks for speaking out tonight.
Thanks for inviting me.
The Senate is considering granting the telecom executives immunity. You lobbied Congress today not to do so. How come?
Well, if they give them immunity, it would probably shut down the lawsuit that I'm a witness for, and then the American people won't find out what's really going on. And so that's why I'm here, to stop immunity. Congress should let the judicial process go forward.
Two-parter here. First, can you explain to those of us who could use the internet but would not be able to tell the difference between its physical form and, you know, a box full of guitar strings, exactly what happened in that secure room or secret room, 641A?
I don't know what goes on in the secret room because I didn't have security clearance. Mm-hmm. But I know what went on outside because my job, I worked in the internet room. My job was to connect circuits into the splitter device, which was hardwired to the secret room. And effectively, the splitter copied the entire data stream of those internet cables into the secret room. And we're talking about phone conversations, email, web browsing, everything that goes across the internet. And that device, the splitters, is a dumb device. It doesn't do any selection at all.
Mm. And the follow-up to that, as you mentioned, you didn't have the security, the NSA clearance. So give us an idea how you know all this, in addition, obviously, to your expertise as a technician.
Well, as a technician, I had the engineering wiring documents, which told me how the splitter was wired to the secret room. And so I had to know that in order to do my job. And so I know that the whatever went across those cables was copied, in the entire data stream was copied into the secret room. The splitter device has no selective capability, just copies everything. And we're talking about domestic traffic as well as international traffic, and that's what got me upset to begin with.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Mr. Klein, this huge distinction the White House made when all this was first revealed, what its defenders still say, oh, we're just intercepting international communications, no domestic communications were affected. I'm taking you don't buy that in the slightest.
No, I know that wasn't true, and that's what got me going in December 05 when the New York Times revealed this, and then the administration came back, the president himself and his various cabinet people trying to argue, and they still do, that it's just international communications. It just affects a handful of people who are making phone calls to the Middle East. And I know the physical equipment, and I know that statement is not true. It involves millions of communications, a lot of it domestic communications, that they're copying wholesale, sweeping up into that secret room.
When you saw this and realized what was going on, what was this like? Was this like sitting there and finding yourself in a scene from the sci-fi flick Invasion of the Body Snatchers? Did it have that sort of horror quality
to it? I'm a little older, so my thought was George Orwell's 1984, yeah. And here I am being forced to connect the Big Brother machine.
Oh, boy.
And I felt that, you know, I was in a funny position, but I needed my job, so I didn't want to make a fuss at the time. But after I retired, I thought about it some more.
In talking to Congress today, what did you hear? Did you get a sense that anybody's prepared to go after not just the telecom execs, but the government officials who ordered this?
I couldn't tell. I'm not a politician, and they play their cards close to the vest. All I can do is emphasize again that they're copying everything. This is a violation of the Constitution. It's domestic traffic. It's phone calls as well as email, and something should be done to stop it, and Congress should not kill the judicial process.
The nice thing is that if there is anything that's going to stop it, it's going to be because people like you have the courage to do something about
it.
Mark Klein, formerly of AT&T, great thanks for joining us, and great thanks for what you're doing. Truly.
Thank you.
September morning. Now everyone remembers that date. World Trade Center worker William Rodriguez, lucky to be coming in late. He'd been clocking into his janitor job for 20 long years, don't you know? He'd even survived the 93 basement bombing that injured a thousand or so. As he walked into the maintenance office, right down there on sub-level 1, his buddy Felipe stormed in the room screaming. In panic and pain he did run. When a fiery blast from the elevator shaft burned the skin off his face and his arms, Felipe the screaming, explosion, explosion. And then came the sound of alarm.
My friends, welcome back to episode 49 of Media Monarchy. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. It's November 9th, 2007, as I come to you live from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com, and also the Revere Radio Network. And you can hit me up on MySpace and Yahoo and iTunes and Skype with Media Monarchy as your keyword. And the podcasts are available thanks to RadioForAll.net. And so we just heard the Ballad of William Rodriguez. And that's actually uncredited, so I don't know who did it, but it's off of 911keymaster.com. That's one of William Rodriguez's sites. And he was in Portland Tuesday night at Brabati's Pan, giving a talk and presentation. And that was, if you listened to last week's episode, Barry Ball of the Oregon Truth Alliance was in here to kind of bring attention to that event. And it was a good time. When I got there and was getting through the door, showing the doorman, you know, my bag, I had nothing in it. I did actually have a knife, but I didn't tell him that. because I was going to work. I cut open hundreds of boxes at work. I had a box knife. But anyway, as I was standing there going through that, William Rodriguez walks out the front door just to come outside and look around. So I saw him immediately. It's going to be like going to a concert and seeing the lead singer before you even go in. So that was cool. I said, hey, how you doing? Shook his hand. It was nice to see him. And it was a good show. Well over 100 people there. Met Jenny Ross of the Oregon Truth Alliance. Hung out a little bit with Alex Ansari of Outside the Box. Met some new people and had a good time. I took a few little videos with my little Sony CyberShot, but the audio is terrible. I was going to play it, but I don't think I will because it's not going to sound good for you. But the video is posted up to YouTube, and it's in the posting on MediaMonarchy.com under 9/11 hero William Rodriguez in Portland. And so, once again, to reiterate for you, William Rodriguez was the custodian in charge of three 110-story stairwells in the North Tower of the World Trade Center on the day it was destroyed. As the holder of a master key, he was able to personally save 15 people from certain death and helped New York City firefighters evacuate many others from the tower before it fell. Rodriguez shared his harrowing experience at Verbody's Pan, and he also explained deep disappointment with the serious inadequacies of the 9/11 Commission report. Rodriguez has been a guest at the White House on five occasions and has been recognized as a national hero by the Senate of Puerto Rico. Rodriguez has used his recognition as one of the true heroes of that tragic day to help draft and pass legislation on behalf of victims' family members and survivors. He's also helped raise millions of dollars for the victims of 9/11 and their families and to bring attention to the health concerns of thousands of first responders who are now sick with Ground Zero Syndrome. And he even lobbied for the creation of the 9/11 Commission along with the Jersey Girls. Though he appeared before the commission, his private testimony was excluded from the final report, as we heard in the song. Rodriguez now questions the serious gaps in the official story. He calls for a thorough, energetic, and internationally based investigation to uncover and explain every possible aspect, failure, and contributing circumstance leading to the 9/11 events. A New Jersey resident, Rodriguez worked in the North Tower of the World Trade Center for almost 20 years. Almost daily, he met with co-workers for breakfast in the famous 106th floor restaurant in the North Tower. Nearly 200 people, including most of William's friends, were in the restaurant on 9/11, and none survived. So he was there. Tickets were $10. There were a lot of free DVDs and handouts by some of the tables there. And posted up in the story along with the video that I think, if you, you know, when you watch the video, you can see the lips move and you can help, you know, you can hear it better. But also posted up the photo that I took of me with William Rodriguez. So that's up there of us shaking hands in the photo. I got my headphones hanging around me. So that was good. So staying on the 9/11 tip and moving along because we're running out of time, let's step it up here. Former NFL star is the latest to question the official 9/11 story. It's coming from Paul Joseph Watson. Former Dallas Cowboys and Houston Oilers lineman Mark Stepnoski has become the latest notable public figure to question the government's official 9/11 story, speaking to an Indiana newspaper about his fascination with the 9/11 truth movement and his doubts about Building 7, insider trading, and the alleged hijackers. In an interview with the Indiana-based Erie Times-News published Sunday, November 4th, with a link for you to that full Q&A, Stepnoski, it's S-T-E-P-N-O-S-K-I, speaks at length about his deep research into the events of 9/11 and why the official explanation seems suspect. And then, a couple days later, he appeared on the Alex Jones Show, and we're going to listen to my quick little edit of Mark Stepnoski questioning 9/11.
Yeah, that was a Tuesday, which that was my last year playing football in the NFL, and that was our day off. So I happened to catch a decent amount of it on TV, and I just remember at the time thinking to myself, you know, is this really a terrorist attack on us by a foreign nation, or is this a false flag operation being conducted by our government? And the reason I say that is because for years leading up to that, I had read several books about the Kennedy assassination, about Watergate, and also an excellent book, Oklahoma City and the Politics of Terror.
Yes.
Which really kind of laid out a lot of the unofficial story about that event, and I noticed there were a lot of parallels between that event and 9/11, as far as bombs being found in the building, scientists coming out and saying that an ammonium nitrate bomb could never cause that much damage. I read another book about McVeigh's trial called Others Unknown, which was actually written by the gentleman who represented him, and he was convinced that there were other people involved in that event that never were brought to justice. So there were just a lot of similarities between the two. And, you know, once that event occurred, I was skeptical. And then obviously, you know, once you start following it from the get-go, you're exposed constantly to information to reinforce your belief. Well, I just think that, you know, growing up reading books about the Kennedy assassination, books like High Treason, you know, there's so many books out there and videos. The Men Who Killed Kennedy, the five-part series that's played on cable television, was really well done. But that was just a great introduction over the years of, you know, some of the clandestine activities that occur with the military and with the intelligence services, things that you're never going to see in mainstream media. And then again, you know, just going along that line, throughout that time period, studying the Vietnam War, Watergate, all these things that signify a cover-up by the government. As time goes on, it's just you become more and more aware as a citizen that secrecy is the rule of the day with our government. And any time that anything revelatory comes to light regarding the nefarious activities of our government, it's immediately discredited and hushed up. So, you know, fortunately, we live in an era where alternative media provides true sources of information that can't be sanitized by corporations. Absolutely. And, you know, we see things like that all the time. You know, recently, this past summer, documents were released proving that, you know, the CIA often worked hand-in-hand with organized crime figures to implement their plans. All these things that at the time would have been considered quote-unquote conspiracy theory are now being substantiated as being true. So again, fortunately, we live in a time where information is a little bit more accessible, so it's becoming harder and harder for a corrupt government to cover up their illegal activities. You know, in the 60s, it took years and years before the Zapruder film was even released. You know, now people can see things right away.
Now they admit Gulf of Tonkin was staged just as we always knew. Now they declassified, totally staged.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought the movie The Fog of War with Robert McNamara did a great job of just letting people know what that behind-the-scenes planning consists of, you know? And there's so many parallels. You know, you look at that, the false intelligence leading to war, same thing that's going on now. You know, history really does repeat itself. But like you said earlier, if people don't read and they're not familiar with history, it's not as apparent to them that these things happen over and over again throughout time.
Well, history's like having the other team's playbook, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You know, it's when you see you know, modern events unfold around you, it's a lot easier to interpret them if you have read their mail, so to speak, ahead of time.
Now, what made you decide to take the plunge for 9/11 Truth?
Well, it just became a question of not really being able to be quiet about it anymore. I've talked to my friends about it all the time for the last 6 years. You know, I'll gladly speak with anybody who wants to talk about it. And initially, you know, people were very reluctant to even entertain the possibility that it was an inside job. But again, as the years have gone on, as time has gone on, you know, now we're, you know, 6-7 years out, enough information is out there to where people are willing to consider it more seriously. You know, you're probably familiar with Peter Phillips from Project Censored.
Oh, absolutely.
I love that, his books. Read them every year. He calls it a threshold concept. You know, people really need to get to the point where they can assimilate enough information to make that leap, to go, to think, you know, beyond the parameters that they already possess. Yeah, it's, you know, people, when you try to hit them with this all at once, if they're totally uninformed and this information is entirely foreign to them, they're really not willing to entertain it because it's just too much of a paradigm shift for them. But for people who gradually are exposed to more and more information, it's less and less of a shock to them. I think we've reached that point now because honestly, when you look at the information that's out there and the credibility of the sources, anybody now who still believes the official story of 9/11 is either incredibly naive or exhibiting complete and total denial.
Are you one of those? So that was definitely not a dumb jock. Former NFL star, two-time Super Bowl winner, I think. Mark Stepnosky, the latest to question the official conspiracy theory of 9/11. Shifting gears once again, jumping to Press TV. Canadian cleared of terrorism charges. A Canadian man of Pakistani origin who was arrested in Afghanistan for allegedly having connections with Al-Qaeda has been released. Suhail Qureshi, 24, was allowed to return to Canada a month ago after Afghan authorities found no evidence linking him to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. The intelligence, police, and security organs tried their best in order to find any evidence showing that he was planning to do something, but there was nothing found, Afghan justice official Saki Abbasi told CBC. Qureshi and his family have so far not spoken to the media about the arrest. Qureshi was arrested at a Kabul bus station in May on suspicion of attending a militant training camp in Pakistan and was jailed in a Kabul prison. Jumping back to Raw Story and getting into Hillary Clinton, fake neocon war hawk Democrat. Something interesting last Saturday on Saturday Night Live. They had Brian Williams of NBC News as the guest. And in a sketch poking fun at the most recent Democratic debate, the reprehensible newsman made a shocking admission. Quote, incidentally, this arrangement was all determined by the drawing of lots, except for Senator Clinton, who we're deliberately placing in the center since all of us in the media want her to become the nominee.
All right, gentlemen, in about 25 minutes here, one of the stage managers will come by to take you all individually to your places for tonight's debate. I did want to give you a heads up on the arrangement of the podiums tonight on stage. There will be as follows, and I'll read from left to right. We'll start with Senator Dodd, then Senator Edwards, then to you, Governor Richardson, then Senator Clinton, then Senator Biden, then Senator Obama, and finally, Representative Kucinich. Incidentally, this arrangement was all determined by the drawing of lots, except for Senator Clinton, who were deliberately placing in the center since all of us in the media want her to be the nominee.
Yeah. I'm sorry, what about me? I don't think you said my name.
Well, you're absolutely right, Senator Gravel, and obviously there's been some sort of miscommunication.
Okay, no problem.
Now, gentlemen, I'm afraid I'm going to have to run. I have a 15-minute pre-debate interview with Senator Clinton. We're going to ask her about her plans for her first 100 days in office. I wish you all good luck tonight, although we, again, in the media, have pretty much made up our minds to go with Senator Clinton. We'll see you in a few minutes.
Thank you,
Brian. Thank you.
Okay, well, Obama's on his way. Are we all agreed if Hillary is going to be stopped, we got to go after her big time tonight, otherwise it's over. Mm-hmm. Huh? Mm-hmm. As for Obama, we'll deal with him later.
Right.
Well, the problem, Senator Edwards, is when you go after Hillary, you're attacking a woman. Now, how do you do that?
Well, I think I know a way. Governor Richardson, of all of us, you know, you're in the best position to really take her on, you know, because of the half-Mexican thing.
Uh-huh. Well, how exactly do I do that?
Well, for example, you know, if she brings up, say, her plan to fund universal early childhood education, you know, you can say, as someone who's half-Mexican, you know, I consider that anti-Hispanic.
Man, that'll knock her right out of the race.
Anti-Hispanic? Are you kidding me? She'll be toast.
All right, first off, that doesn't even make sense. I mean, how is funding early childhood education anti-Hispanic? I mean, it might even be pro-Hispanic.
No. It doesn't matter. You're half Mexican. If you say something's anti-Hispanic, it's anti-Hispanic.
Yeah, nobody would dare argue with you because you're half Mexican, you know? Unless they're, you know, three-quarters Mexican or full-on Mexican.
Boy, I wish I was half Mexican.
Mm-hmm. You know, I got a better idea. Why not let Senator Dodd or Senator Biden nail her on her lack of experience? I mean, the two have been in the Senate 20 years longer than she has.
What's the point in Joe or myself attacking Hillary? Everybody knows neither of us has the slightest chance at being nominated.
Exactly. We shouldn't even be here.
All right, I got it. Senator Edwards, why don't you sue her?
Sue her?
Yeah. Take her to court. I could hold her up for months.
Sewer for what?
I don't know. I'm sure you can think of something. You're an ambulance chaser.
Guys, you know, it's not that simple. You know, I can't just sue her. If I take somebody to court, I need a legitimate reason.
Oh, really? Since when?
Uh-oh. Oh, switch.
I said, since when?
All right, well, I'll think about it. Congressman Kucinich, any ideas?
Wouldn't it be a great time to bring up her vote against my proposal to create a federal Department of Cat Outreach? I think it's a good issue. We have a Secretary of Defense, why not a Secretary of Cat Outreach? Well, I'm going to mention it.
Right. Senator Gravel, you've been out of politics for almost 30 years and are obviously quite mentally unstable. Any thoughts?
I tell you, I'm so furious about Hillary's vote to go into Iran. If I get a chance tonight, I'm just going to deck her. I swear to God, I'm going to lay her out.
Yeah, okay, well, see, that is exactly the kind of thing I think would be counterproductive.
Mike, you don't want to go hitting a woman, even Hillary Clinton. Look, I'm going to be 97 years old next month. That's a fair fight, isn't it? Oh, I knew you pansies wouldn't back me. Hey, where'd you get that coffee?
Oh, through this door down the hall.
Oh. Mike, easy on the coffee. How about some celestial seasonings instead?
I cannot believe no one's told him he's not in the debate.
It's kind of cruel, actually.
Well, shouldn't somebody tell him?
Not me.
I'm not going to tell him. That guy's nuts. Well,
anyway, not our problem.
Hey, you know what I'm going to do tonight? Right after Hillary talks about how she's got this new health care plan or whatever, and they go to me for a response, I'm just going to pause for a second and then say, where's the beef?
What?
That's all I'm going to say. I'm just going to go, where's the beef? Lights out, Hillary.
Where's the beef? What the hell does that mean?
Oh, it was a TV ad like 25 years ago.
Right. There it is. Hey, where's the beef?
Also, Joe, I think that line has been used before.
Really? Well, I was not aware of that. Well, forget it then. That's right.
All right. You guys probably won't like this idea, but I think we should kidnap her.
What?
I'm serious. When she gets here, a couple of us grab her while the others chloroform her and tie her up.
You know, that's actually not a bad idea.
Well, wait a second. Do any of us even have rope and chloroform?
I do, in my car.
Guys, I will not be a party to any act of violence.
You know, this could work. As long as we agree on a story and stick to it.
Again, I refuse to be a party to violence.
I gotta say, I'm liking this plan.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
All right then, Dennis, are you in or out?
Oh, I'm in. Just don't hurt her.
Hi, everybody. Sorry to interrupt. I'm Ann Meyer with the Debate Commission here at Drexel. Senator Gravel, could I speak with you privately for a moment?
Okay.
No.
Yikes.
What? No light! Oh, no, I don't know what I'm gonna go there! Stay up there!
what's the plan now?
Well, I guess we'll just have to go after Hillary on the issues. You know, the one where she's vulnerable.
Nothing wrong with that.
We can be polite but tough.
And just hope that the media portrays us fairly and not like a bunch of sexist bullies.
All right, let's do it.
God, I hate Saturday Night Live. It's so slow and plotting, and whatever funny point they have, they beat it to death for 8 minutes. So I'm sorry I had to subject you to that whole thing. But you get the idea of the media basically saying they've decided they want Hillary for the nominee, which is, of course, true. And as I've told you time and time again, Rupert Murdoch, Roger Ailes, and Fox News are going to be behind Hillary Clinton. It's fake. Someone that's not fake, though, is Ron Paul, and he raised over $4 million in one day, leading us to say, wow, those spam bots must have bank accounts. So one of the first of tons of articles about it, New York Times, on Monday, a group of Ron Paul supporters helped raise more than $4.07 million in one day, and it went up more than that, approaching what the campaign raised in the entire last quarter, all through a website called thisnovember5th.com, a reference to the day the British commemorate the thwarted bombing. Many fans of Mr. Paul know the day primarily through a movie based on the futuristic graphic novel V for Vendetta by occultist Alan Moore and David Lloyd, in which a terrorist model after Guy Fawkes battles a fascist government that has taken over Britain. The Paul campaign has raised more than $6.84 million in the first 5 weeks of this quarter, more than the $5 million it raised from July to October. And then the Washington Post has Ron Paul's record online haul. November 5th marks not only Paul's best fundraising haul in a single day, but online observers say it's also the most money raised by a candidate on the web in a single day, and it wasn't even over yet at that writing. And then tons of other stories. Jenny Ross of the Oregon Truth Alliance sent out a list. ABC News, Ron Paul is money, Wall Street Journal, Paul supporters hope to make campaign history, Free Market News, Ron Paul Donation Day looks to be a big success, USA Daily, Ron Paul's campaign takes in over $5 million so far, Daily Paul, MIT supporters, that has a good photo, they hung a banner on their big campus building, it says, remember, remember the 5th of November. And there was USA Today, New York Times, and the Carpetbagger Report, and Talking Points Memo, Daily Dish, Politico, Washington Times. Tons of stuff. And I believe it was, yes, Paul Joseph Watson wrote the article, Spam Bots Don't Send Imaginary Cash. Ron Paul's presidential campaign received a whopping $4.2 million in donations over 24 hours, eclipsing any of the other Republican candidates, and putting debunkers to shame who had attempted to discredit the campaign by suggesting Paul's support was imaginary, inflated, and exaggerated as a result of internet spamming. Here's some news for the scoffers and the establishment talking heads who have engaged in propaganda assault to try and hoodwink Americans into thinking Paul is not a frontrunner. $4.2 million doesn't grow on trees and it isn't plucked out of cyberspace without real people being behind it. The Texas congressman has now raised over $7 million since October 1st, putting him well on track to achieve a goal of $12 million by the end of the year. And that article goes on, and so am I. Jump into the telegraph.co.uk. Police retain DNA of petty crime suspects. Suspects accused of trivial crimes, such as picking wildflowers or defacing coins, can have their DNA stored for life on a national database. A report by police chiefs lists more than 5,000 offenses that qualify for lifelong inclusion on the database. Anyone arrested for any of the crimes will have his or her DNA taken and stored, even if charges are later dropped or the suspect is acquitted in court. The offenses show up in employment vetting checks for years after the event. Campaigners called the guidelines a step on the road to a, quote, surveillance society, and said the inclusion of petty offenses was accelerating the growth of the database, which already holds details on 4 million people. The 210-page list of crimes drawn up by the Association of Chief Police Officers, ACPO, with the link for you to the big, long PDF of all this stuff. It includes minor offenses like opening an incorrectly delivered packet, an offense under the 2000 Postal Services Act, wantonly disturbing any inhabitant by any ringing doorbell, an offense under the 1847 Town Police Clauses Act, and picking wildflowers for sale, an offense under the 1968 Theft Act. And there's actually links to those acts on Wikipedia. Police have categorized the crimes in three grades of severity. If an adult is convicted of a crime in the least serious category, Group C, it'll show up in employment checks for the next 10 years. If the offender admits guilt and accepts a police caution, it will show up for 5 years. After that period, the only potential employers who will see it are those conducting enhanced checks on job seekers applying to work with children. Now, I think this is an AP report. Yes. Their headline, Army marks record low level of recruits. Mine was U.S. Army running low on cannon fodder, and I included the dictionary definition of cannon fodder. Soldiers, especially infantrymen, who run the greatest risk of being wounded or killed in warfare. Soldiers, sailors, or other military personnel regarded as likely to be killed or wounded in combat. Soldiers who are regarded as expendable in the face of artillery fire. So once again, coming from the AP, the Army began its recruiting year, October 1st, with fewer signed up for basic training than in any year since it became an all-volunteer service in 1973. General William S. Wallace, whose duties as Commander of Army Training and Doctrine Command, TRADOC, include management of recruiting. He told reporters at the Pentagon that the historic dip will make it harder to achieve the full-year recruiting goal after just barely reaching it in the year ended September 30th. Achieving the Army's recruiting goals, a challenge in the best of times, is not only more difficult now, but also of more consequence. That's because the Army has decided it must grow its active duty force by several thousand soldiers a year in order to relieve strain on war-weary troops. General Wallace said he expects to reach the goal of 80,000 recruits with extra effort by his recruiters. It's going to be another tough recruiting year, the four-star general said. And of course, we've covered on the show, the way they'll get around that is that you just start to enlist, you know, felons, convicted illegals, gang members, thugs. It's a moral waiver. Jumping to martial law in Pakistan, it's happening, and the Pentagon says, meh. Coming from thenews.com.pk, international news, Pentagon says emergency does not affect U.S. support to Pakistan. The Pentagon said General Pervez Musharraf's declaration of state of emergency in Pakistan does not affect U.S. military support. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Iran-Contra criminal Gates is monitoring the fast-developing situation. Pakistan is a very important ally in the war on terror, and he's closely following the developments there. The emergency declaration does not impact our military support of Pakistan or its efforts in the war on terror. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who we're going to get to in a minute, is taking the administration's lead in dealing with the situation, Morrell spokesman said, and Gates had not spoken to Musharraf, and he had no plans to during his 17-hour flight to Beijing. Jumping to the San Jose Mercury News and to some more crazy drills. There's a California bioterror drill at a mock concert. How'd you like to spend the day inside a crowded stadium pretending to vomit and be drenched in fake chemical gas? Sound like fun? Well, you won't get paid, but you will be helping out local firefighters, police officials, and paramedics practice for the biggest and most unusual emergency drill in California, a mock bioterrorist attack on November 14th in Silicon Valley, where 500 guests are attending an all-night rock concert at Municipal Stadium in San Jose. And this is under something called Golden Guardian, and I got the link for you, goldenguardian.org, and you can read all about that. November 14th, that's going to happen. And now we got the latest from Alex Ansarian Outside the Box. He posted up episodes 126 and 127 and also a show on We the People Radio Network. And all the links and all the videos are there on MediaMonarchy.com. Like I said, it was good hanging out with Alex at the William Rodriguez event. He had quite the busy week on Outside the Box and his radio show. He had Alex Jones, David Icke, and Jim Fetzer, three of the, for better or worse, bigwigs in the alternative news media research community. So let's listen to a quick mix of all three guests from Alex Ansari, Outside the Box.
He joins me tonight to talk about his new documentary film, Endgame. Thanks for joining me, Alex.
Alex, it's good to be here with you.
Tell us a little bit about Endgame before we get started here.
Well, it's the proof of the North American Union, the proof of the global elite's plan for world government, but world government is only a means to an end. Once world government is in place and their official public documents, they plan the orderly extermination of at least 5 billion of the population. And we walk through it in Endgame. People can check out all the free trailers and information at whatistheendgame.com. They can also watch the film for free already on Google Video. It's not in the high quality you'll find at whatistheendgame.com or prisonplanet.tv, but I don't care. Just check out the information and then go check all the quotes, documents, and video clips you see. They're already putting cancer viruses in your vaccines, mercury. They're already poisoning your water. It's all documented. It was all planned more than 100 years ago. These people are cold-blooded, wicked, murdering geniuses.
David, we're not going to obsess upon the New World Order tonight. It's only because, you know, I feel that there's an isolation between multiple groups of consciousness on the planet today. We have the sustainable group over here in their camp. We have, or you would call it the sustainable program. And then we have the police state faction, anti-police state faction over here. You have the New Agers separated over here in their box, going through their program. And then we have a couple of others, those that think they're on the left and those that think they're on the right. Let's talk about this separation of humanity that we've seen for thousands of years, and increasingly so today, in terms of it being a root cause of some of the problems that we're facing today.
You're absolutely right, Alex. It's a very, very important area. That, you know, the name of the show is Out of the Box, and one of the great illusions is when you think you're out of the box, but you're actually not. You can be in a bigger box than most people, but you're not necessarily out of it. And I think it's very important that those that are researching the conspiracy and those that are acting in these various areas and operating in these various areas you talk about don't get caught in their own belief system and therefore exchange one box for another. Because it's like Socrates in ancient Greece is supposed to have said, wisdom is knowing how little we know. We have to keep our minds open. But the key thing for me, Alex, is that the separation, the key separation, is the way those manipulating the planet, who understand the nature of reality and understand what the physical body is, and have passed this knowledge on through their generations, through the highest level of the secret society network, and have systematically, through things like inquisitions and what have you, sucked that knowledge that was once widely available far way back out of the public domain, although it's now coming back, which is why we're seeing this change. And it is use that understanding of reality and how we create it and what the physical body is to hold us in what I call body consciousness, five sense consciousness. When you can focus people's attention only on body consciousness, they disconnect their awareness of who they really are, which is infinite consciousness, the eternal consciousness that continues after the physical body, what we call dies. And if you can hold people in five sense consciousness, body consciousness, then they have one place to look to get their information about themselves, their world, and what's going on. And that is through the eyes and the ears. And that information comes from the mainstream media, overwhelmingly, which is controlled by these people, and through what we bravely call the education system, which is nothing more than indoctrination machine, programming children to become the adults that suits the agenda of control. So that's the key thing that they're doing. I want to isolate people in five states of consciousness. And as you awaken, and more people are doing this now, because what I was told, as I said a few minutes ago, through that psychic, that there was a spiritual revolution coming and people were going to wake up from their amnesia. Well, demonstrably, it is happening now on an increasing scale. But we have to not think that, I'm awake now. No, you're awakening now. We have to keep this process of opening more and more. When you do awaken, you move your point of observation from five sense consciousness to a much higher level of perception. And you are, if you like, in this world physically, in terms of your body, but you're not of this world in terms of your point of observation. And it's at that point that you're looking into the world and you can observe it from a much greater level of understanding and perception than if you're caught in five-sense consciousness, which is where most people are. The key is that we need to become conscious, and there's lots of people, and good luck to them. I admire and support and congratulate them on what they do, but there are a lot of people in the area of conspiracy research who are also in five-sense consciousness. They are looking primarily or only at like political scams and the banking scams and manipulation of wars, all of which I do, and it's absolutely right that this information is known. But if we stay in five-sense consciousness, the only way you are out is to have five-sense reactions, like stockpiling weapons, like fighting the enemy and all that stuff, which means that you're just another version of what you're actually seeking to expose. We have to become conscious, because if we don't, then we're in trouble.
And then you also look at the element of the Department of Homeland Security and their employees. They actually have little name tags. IDs are on their neck that define their position. Controllers, how ironic is that? Controllers was the main position I saw. And they're overseeing the operation. I'm thinking they're gathering a lot of information, secure information about our city. And that's what I see when I see hundreds of people sitting down at laptops looking at everything they can about our local resources, our energy system. Yeah. There, you know, there were a couple quick blackouts during Top Off 4 in different parts of the city, and I couldn't get any answers on why the blackouts took place.
Well, I gather the interstate was even shut down for a period of time during the earlier exercise, so I don't know. You know, my opinion is that if you think there's a real opportunity, a real possibility that one of these exercises could be used to conceal the real deal, that it may be worthwhile to talk about it, which is what I take to be the role of Captain May. So I'm actually very much of a supporter of his efforts. I mean, you cannot judge whether you've been successful by focusing attention on one of these drills that you may possibly have done just enough to keep it from going live. But I think that there's, the situation politically for this administration is so desperate that I think, and so many Republicans have endorsed the idea that if there were another terrorist drill, it could salvage the prospects of the Republican Party in the next election and redeem Bush's, poll numbers and so forth. I mean, it's so crass from the other side. They even have memoranda, as I'm sure you're aware, that have circulated among senior Republicans talking about these things and endorsing them. That, I mean, in any other day and age, we'd be describing these people as traitors. And today, you know, they somehow pass for being sophisticated political operatives. It's really disgusting.
We have the money men that helped Bush get into office now, putting their money behind Hillary. And we see that as well, in addition to what you're saying.
Yeah, I worry about that. Hillary's gone to become such a hawk. I mean, she ought to be, a moderating force, and I don't see it at all. That troubles me tremendously. I mean, right now, the candidate who seems to me to be most outspoken on behalf of the interests of the people of the United States is Ron Paul.
Ron Paul, yes. This November5th.com is a website you may or may not want to check out if you want to help out. Great time to donate would be November 5th. They're looking to get 100,000 people, donate $100, which would bring it to a grand total of $10 million. It's funny, Jim. You know, the mainstream media gets it. They know why Ron Paul has support. I don't understand how they can spin it the way they're spinning it and still go to sleep at night.
So that's Alex Ansari, alexansari.com, with Jim Fetzer, David Icke, and Alex Jones. Last couple stories jumping to the Associated Press. Condoleezza Rice to be subpoenaed in espionage case. Judge okays calls for intel officials to discuss talks with pro-Israel lobbyists. Dateline Washington, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and more than a dozen other current and former intelligence officials must testify about their conversations with pro-Israel lobbyists, a federal judge ruled last Friday in an espionage case. Lawyers for two former American-Israel Public Affairs Committee lobbyists, APAC, facing charges have subpoenaed Rice, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, Deputy National Security Advisor Elliot Abrams, and several others to testify at their trial next year. Prosecutors had challenged the subpoenas in federal court. lobbyists Stephen Rosen and Keith Wasserman maintain the Israeli interest group played an unofficial but sanctioned role in crafting foreign policy, and that Rice and the others can confirm it. If they ultimately testify in court, the trial in federal court in suburban Alexandria, Virginia, could offer a behind-the-scenes look at the way U.S. foreign policy is crafted. And yes, it could. So jumping once again to SourceWatch.org and the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee entry, AIPAC describes itself as America's pro-Israel lobby. And there's a lot there about their fundraising and about, of course, Larry Franklin spying for AIPAC, passing secrets. And there's links to read about Iran-Contra 2, the Israel lobby, Jonathan Pollard, USS Liberty, yeah, and all that. I think I've told you, Larry Franklin was actually an adjunct professor at Shepherd University where I went to school, and I unknowingly served coffee to that spying AIPAC bastard. Finally, though, on this episode of Media Monarchy, one more time, jumping to the Associated Press, pipe bomb locks down Arizona nuclear plant.
A major scare hits the nation's largest power plant in Arizona, forcing it to temporarily shut down. Security officers outside the Palo Verde nuclear power plant, which is west of Phoenix, spotted what looked like a pipe bomb in the back of a contractor's pickup truck. Police have now identified the man. The
employee's name is Roger Hurd, born August 25th of 1946. The vehicle that he was driving was a small maroon Ford pickup truck with South Carolina plates.
Officials say Hurd had security clearance to some areas, but that the contractor had not been inside the plant since August.
The individual here had a badge and was allowed into the middle level, if you would, but he had not actually been in the physical part of that plant since August 21st.
Hurd told investigators the bomb wasn't his and did not know how it ended up in his truck. Police also say the explosive device was not hidden when he attempted to enter the plant.
At this point, Mr. Hurd is not in custody. He has not been arrested. We are continuing the investigation to determine the circumstances of how that device arrived on the nuclear generating station's premises. The fortunate thing here is that the device was not a threat to the plant itself and not a threat to the general public.
Authorities searched Hurd's Phoenix apartment, and plant officials have pulled his security clearance until the investigation concludes. The lockdown was lifted later in the day, and the Department of Homeland Security says there's no known terrorism linked to the incident. Sophia Manos, The Associated Press.
And that's going to do it for this 49th episode of Media Monarchy, November 9th, 2007. Let's hit very quickly the list of interesting visitors to MediaMonarchy.com in the last week. We had the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. They Googled anti-Israel videos and landed on MediaMonarchy.com. We had the Carroll County Public Library of Westminster, Maryland, the State of Minnesota, the State University of New York at Buffalo. We had Tyson Foods Incorporated, the Drug Enforcement Agency, at least four times on MediaMonarchy.com. The Hillsborough County Public Schools in Tampa, Florida, they Googled military-industrial complex JFK assassination. Someone at DreamWorks Animation Googled Tavistock Institute plus 9-inch nails. And I recommend you do the same thing. We also had Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary. They hit me up with my link on the good folks at blacklistednews.com. University of San Francisco from the revereradio.net link. Louisiana State University Medical Center, they Googled free immunization shots for adults in New Orleans. Google Incorporated in New York City was reading about Top Off 4. Locke, Liddell & Sapp Law Firm in Houston, Texas. The Ernst & Young Law Firm in Brooklyn. Staino Incorporated Tooth Stain Removers out of New York Googled Mark Stepnoski Dallas Cowboys 9/11. New Mexico State University, the United Rotary Brush Corporation, was reading about William Rodriguez, as was J.P. Morgan and Chase. And they all visited MediaMonarchy.com, and I thank them. And I thank you for listening to this episode, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com, and the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.net. Visit me on MySpace. Send me an email, yahoo, MediaMonarchy at yahoo.com, and you can get the podcast. Thanks to iTunes and RadioForAll.net. A couple quick things that I haven't hit that I wanted to hit. Something about the Law of the Sea Treaty, LOST, Lost, that would basically give de facto power to the UN over international waters. And in addition to the martial law in Pakistan, we got it going on in Georgia as well. I went to see American Gangster, Ridley Scott's new movie that was not very good. It was kind of like a TV cop movie. But there was a guy in it, Albert Jones, who I've worked in theater before, so that was cool. He didn't say anything, but he was in it. And all the trailers before the movie were nothing but talking about the NSA and the CIA over and over again, and there's even one, I forget the name of it, but it's basically about a fake assassination of a president and a lot of TV fakery. So that's interesting, and we'll keep an eye peeled for that, especially as we've talked about the assassination meme here in recent weeks. But I digress, and I don't have time, and I'm over time, so that's going to do it. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. I thank you for listening. If you enjoy the show, help me out. Add a link. Send something. Download it. Email me, please. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.